In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. In Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Huck meets a boy his age named Buck Grangerson. Huck, if you remember the story, has an abusive alcoholic father. Buck Grangerson, we're told, was actually reared in a rather aristocratic upbringing, which is all the more ironic because Buck tells Huck that his family has been engaged in a generations-long feud, killing each other for reasons they forget and have forgotten. And so when Huck finally asks Buck, "What is a feud?" Buck says this, "Well, the feud is this way. Man has a quarrel with another man and kills him. And then that other man's brother kills him. And then the other brothers on both sides go for one another. And then the cousins chip in. And by, everybody's killed off. And there ain't no more feud. But it's kind of slow and takes a long time." Nothing like a kid to state the facts without any attachment to the horror of what he's speaking of. But he gets to the heart of a feud like perhaps no adult can. A feud is an unrelenting, unprofitable fight to find a fallacious form of justice. It never really gets what it's out to achieve, since in the time the family from whom you've sought justice tries to get it back from you themselves, for themselves. Brothers and sisters, what came home to us so profoundly about 72 hours ago is that our nation is still in very much something like a feud, a foolish kind of fight to find a fallacious form of justice. And as we have argued for the last several weeks in this series, we have said that Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is out to reimagine life for us. Brothers and sisters, if that is true, then how does the Sermon on the Mount reimagine an end to this feud? How does the Sermon on the Mount reimagine a kind of justice where this doesn't have to happen anymore? And how might we as a church respond to this kind of moment, to this kind of feud, to this kind of foolish seeking for a fallacious form of justice? We weren't going to preach this sermon this week. We were supposed to talk about oaths. And then Thursday happened, and we believed that something else had to be said. And it just so happens that the next passage said what we thought needed to be said. Jesus is going to lay a foundation for that kind of justice, for an end to that kind of feud, in the way he asks and answers four implicit questions, starting in verse 38. Don't stand, just listen. "Again, you've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other as well. And if anyone would sue you to take your tunic, give him your cloak also. And if anyone forces you to go with him 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to whoever begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. How's this feud going to end? How is justice, a true and enduring justice, can prevail? It's first of all going to come from an answer to this question. What of the person who's out to do me harm? I've already mentioned their names, but you may have heard of them this week, Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. Sterling died from a gunshot on Monday. Castile died from a gunshot on Wednesday. For Sterling, he was sitting outside of a convenience store in Louisiana selling CDs. And an erroneous call came in to police saying that he was brandishing a weapon. And cops show up. And a hasty and reckless altercation ensues. And by the end of it, Sterling is dead. Philando Castile had been pulled over in Minnesota for a busted taillight. And he informed the officer that he was carrying a weapon that he had a legal right to carry. And in reaching into his back pocket to show him the permit, the officer thought he was reaching for a gun and shot him. And he died there in the car with his wife and daughter, witness to the event. Their names are both now part of a long and lengthening list of Black people who've died in altercations with police in situations that continually raise the question of the necessity of lethal force. And it's those names and that list that likely triggered Micah Johnson's twisted and tormented decision to plan, target, and kill 5 Dallas police officers and wound 7 others. Brothers and sisters, there's a lot of Black people in this country whose first thought of the police is fear. And there's a lot of police officers in this country whose first thought of young Black males is fear. And so when the Dallas police chief, as you may have heard him, late or early Friday morning, a man whose own son killed a police officer and whose own son was then killed by other police officers, when that Dallas police chief says, this madness has to stop, this divisiveness between police and people, the question is, how will that madness stop? How will this feud end? It's in part an answer to Jesus' first implicit question, what of the person who's out to harm me? He cites a part of the story of justice unfolding, if only to show where the story of justice is going. And I know that's really abstract and esoteric. What do I mean? Jesus begins that passage citing something that was in 3 of the 5 books of the Torah, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, where it says, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And we hear that. And we think at first, how beastly, how primitive. And for the last 72 hours, we've heard people say, that's what Micah Johnson was doing, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Oh, brothers and sisters, if only he had been conforming to that idea. For encoded within the DNA of that law was 2 notions. One, that justice was important. In a world where justice would not be done, where only justice would be done if you had the power to wreak your own will, an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth would finally bring forth the idea that justice has to be done, regardless of who you are, whether you are a king or a peasant. And it's in that same notion, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that said, if you're going to seek justice, then you must consider the idea of equanimity between crime and consequence. If an eye and eye and a tooth for a tooth had reigned in Herod's mind, John the Baptist would still have had his head. Because in Israel's law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth meant no private citizen could ever render a verdict privately. No private citizen could render a verdict without corroborating and public evidence by witnesses. And no Israelite could ever wreak justice upon a type of a person to bring vengeance for a consequence against another type of person. Oh, if only Micah Johnson had really listened to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But he didn't. But Jesus cites that law in the story of Israel's justice, if only to set up and unfold a larger story to be told about how justice will be found. And he says, in contrast to what they know, Do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to the other one also. Just hear that again. Do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. He's using a phrase with a physical sense, but the harm of which he is speaking can refer to any time that your honor has been defamed, even just your honor. When your dignity has been denied you. And in those moments, whenever you are hurt or you are dishonored, what are the two ordinary responses of humans? Fight or flight? Either answer the aggression with aggression, respond to the defaming with defaming, or to retreat from the scene in ignominy and lick your wounds. Fight or flight. That's how we usually do it. Jesus says, neither works. Neither gets you to the justice that endures. Brothers and sisters, is it not clear from even the last 72 hours that answering violence with violence gets us nowhere? But brothers and sisters, isn't it also clear that in the face of a pattern of violence against a particular people, that something has to be said? Something has to be done to answer that pattern. Those who sought to protest peacefully Thursday night on the streets of Dallas were neither fighting nor were they taking flight. Most of them. They were standing so as to make a point. The racial prejudice shall not stand. Especially when it's costing lives. And so to turn the other cheek is not to retaliate, but it's also not to turn tail either. It's to stand firm. So that offender may see what they've done and perhaps might even be changed by what they see. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this, "Evil will become powerless when it finds no opposing object, no resistance, but instead is willingly born and suffered. Evil meets an opponent for which it is not a match." To turn the other cheek is to deny somebody a second cause for provocation, which may be their undoing. The way of Jesus that is neither fight nor flight does two things. It avoids, obviously, perpetuating a cycle of violence that tears at the fabric of community. You may have seen me post on our Facebook page in the wake of the early morning Friday something that Martin Luther King said. He said, "If I respond to hate with a reciprocal hate, I do nothing but intensify the cleavage in a broken community. I can only close the gap by meeting hate with love." What is sought in violence can't be achieved through violence, but in fact, only through nonviolence. Because, brothers and sisters, what reckless rage has ever redeemed the hearts of those with whom it is angered? This way that Jesus is outlining is avoiding society from falling into an abyss. But he's not just talking about averting disaster. He's also about achieving something in this very counterintuitive, countercultural way. He's out to have us make it possible for our enemy to maybe become an advocate. You've heard me quote Martin Luther King on this one before, but it's worth saying again in the wake of what we know. He said this, "Somehow we must be able to stand up against our most bitter opponents and say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, we will still love you, but be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And one day we will win our freedom. We will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. Turning the other cheek is not just getting everybody to calm down. It's trying to keep a crack in the door that hope and light might stay and come in where violence would otherwise slam it shut and envelop us in darkness. When you were a kid and you went to bed and your mom turned off the light and she closed the door, what did you say? Mommy, leave the door open just a little bit that a little light might come in. Just a little light. I don't want to be encloaked in this darkness entirely. Brothers and sisters, this third way, this way that is neither fighting nor taking flight, is our way of keeping a crack in the door that light might come in. In a context where racial prejudice and police hatred threaten to cover this country, this city with darkness, it's going to be this way of facing one another that we believe who are out to harm us that lets a little light in. So what of the one to do me harm or do me dishonor? We have to release our sense of obligation to defend ourselves and instead embrace a sense of obligation to do anyone who's hostile to us good. When we embrace that, this feud will end and justice will last. But it needs more than that, because there's another question that Jesus raises, and it's this. Not only what of the person who's out to do me harm, but what of the person who means to take what is mine? Jesus tells this almost laughable story that maybe would have elicited a smirk from those who hear it. But in verse 40, he imagines a scene, a courtroom scene, when somebody is suing somebody else for their underwear. The tunic, full-length dress, loose-fitting, cool to the touch. That's your underwear. And somebody is suing somebody else for their underwear. And if that's not laughable enough, Jesus says this: if they're suing you for your underwear, give it to them. And at the same time, give them your cloak. Your cloak was your outer garment. The thing that kept you warm at night, the thing that you slept in. There was even provision in the Torah that said, if you're holding somebody's outer garment, their cloak, as collateral for a debt, then even if at the end of the day they haven't paid off the debt, you've still got to give them their cloak back, because they're going to freeze. Their cloak mattered. It was in that way sacred. And Jesus is saying, if somebody wants your underwear so bad, hey, give it to them. Go naked. Give them your cloak. Why the outlandish sort of picture? Why the even more outlandish way to end the standoff? Because Jesus knows humans. He knows when it comes to contending for our rights or our property, it is so very easy for us to value that thing more than the person with whom we're contending. That which we're fighting over becomes larger than the one we're fighting with. That scene is in a courtroom, but the idea applies to any situation and we find ourselves contending for something or principle that is so dear to us. Jesus is saying, whatever that thing is, whatever that idea is, whatever that ideology is, it can never be as dear as what we have in and from each other. Not if we want the feud to end. Not if we want justice to reign. You know who's giving a remarkable illustration of that this week? The people who are sacrificing something dear in order to value someone more. The cops who were there Thursday night to ensure the safety of people who were protesting the behavior of other cops. The police could have said to themselves, you know what? You're criticizing fellow officers, And I'm an officer, and I will not set aside my right to look past that in order to respect your right to criticize. They could have said that, but they didn't. Because they value those people who wanted to make that statement more than their own concerns. They wanted to hold in esteem those people whose lives that they're entrusted to protect more so than their desire that all police officers be held in respect. Brothers and sisters, across this country, there is a collision between a desire to have one's authority respected and the desire to have one's dignity respected. Both of those things are of value, rightly to be valued. But we see again and again when those things take on a value in excess of our value of one another, we rage, we divide, and we let their lack of value for our authority or our dignity be a pretext for hatred. As it was with the one out to harm us, so it is with those who mean to take what is ours. Jesus is out to get us to value more who they are to us than whatever they might want from us. Otherwise, the feud will not end and justice will not roll. There's a third question he asks, and he answers. Not only what of the person who's out to harm me or the person who's out to take what's mine, but what of the demands of the person who I find it hard to respect? You know enough about Israelite history? Rome had occupied Israel for centuries, but under Roman law, any public official could impress an Israelite into some form of temporary service. Have them carry something, have them courier something, have them transport someone. That was the law. You refuse that, you're liable to punishment. In colonial days of America, you know what the founding fathers did. They issued a directive whereby they could quarter soldiers in your houses during wartime. Except the difference between colonial America and Rome is that Israel hated Rome. There was no love lost between Israelites and Roman public officials. And so for a Roman soldier to call upon an Israelite citizen to do a job for the empire that occupied, that would naturally elicit at best a begrudging compliance. And Jesus is saying, you got to lose the begrudging. Instead, you got to embrace the opportunity to serve. If they ask for 1 mile, hey, go with them too. They ask you to help them get home and they say, take me to the outskirts of Jerusalem. You say to them, tell me your address. We'll go all the way. You got a boss that leans on you, that frustrates you, that exasperates you and says to you, you know what? I need you to work a little overtime this week, maybe a few hours for the next few nights. You say to them, I'll help until that project is done. Brothers and sisters, let me put this phrase, this idea, in a little bit of context. It may be a hard thing to hear. I know it's a hard thing to say, but let me say this. You don't necessarily have to disrespect someone to still fail to respect them. Sounds like a contradiction. Let me say it again. You don't have to necessarily disrespect someone to still fail to respect them. You don't have to be inwardly prejudiced in order to lack a full respect of somebody who's not like you. Even though some police officers have acted with supreme negligence, there are other police officers that are asking everybody else, would you walk in my shoes and feel what I feel and the fear that I fear? And for that to happen, somebody's going to have to go beyond just hearing that story, but to ask them what it feels like and to walk in their shoes. And even though there are some other black people who have spouted hatred to all police officers, there are other black people who only know a different kind of experience and a different kind of treatment from those who are in law enforcement. And they just want someone to understand their story and their experience. And for that to happen, those who are unlike them will have to make provision to understand them. You don't have to disrespect someone in order to fail to respect them in all they're facing. That's true of police officers and black people. That's true of between white people and black people. That's true between any majority culture and any minority culture. And what will cultivate a true respect between parties like that is an interest not just to do what they might ask of you, but to go the extra mile to really to come to understand them, to listen to their story, and ask them what it's like to be them. That way, this feud ends and justice rolls. There's one last question he asks and answers. He says, give to him who begs from you and do not refuse him who would borrow from you. Now, it's fairly clear that Jesus is saying that the way of the kingdom is the way of generosity and the way of kindness. It's a desire to ensure that a person in his need is not left without. But brothers and sisters, just like we said earlier, when it comes to being harmed, there are two impulses that we tend to follow. In the same way, when somebody comes to us in need, there are two impulses that we may follow. One is discomfort inside, and the other is disdain. We may feel a little discomfort inside when we see somebody in their plight. We have chomped down on a waffle fry from Chick-fil-A coming through the drive-thru, and there we see somebody hunched over, probably with some mangy dog that they informally adopted them. And what do? We may drive back and get them a meal. Maybe we just give them a fiver and drive on. And then we say to ourselves, there, I did my little part. Conscience placated. But you know what that was mostly about? It was mostly about you and your discomfort. That's one impulse. There's another, though, on another side of the spectrum, and that's disdain. You might not know somebody from a hole in the wall, but you inevitably start imagining what got them to this point that they're so desperate. And so we think to ourselves, no way am I giving them anything. They did this to themselves. And even if we're right, and even if we're partly true, we don't know because we don't know them. Jesus is leaning against both impulses, discomfort or disdain. We initially feel an obligation to quiet our conscience, or we act as that deprived person's conscience for them by depriving them of what they're asking for. Jesus is out to reimagine a very different obligation. What comports with the kingdom that comes in Jesus is not a reflexive disdain to those who lay their desperate need before us. Neither is it a detached indifference. Let me try to put this in context to our moment. If you're of a majority culture, there are privileges you possess that those of minority culture do not, wherever you are. One can surely attribute certain outcomes to individual effort. That's a truism. It can't be argued. But there are some outcomes that are tied to certain privileges that some people think are just simply givens, or just the product of their effort. Whether it's financial, or access, or power, or just with respect, those are privileges, and you can't just assume that everyone is on a level playing field. What does that have to do with following Jesus? There is no institution like the church that desires to see its every person flourish because they're made in the image of God and they've been made to be conformed to the image of Jesus. But unless we are aware of certain privileges a majority culture has, we will never do everything that we can to ensure that every culture within the church has opportunity to flourish. We have said a lot, and we've probably provoked more questions than we'd ever have time for in Q&A if we were having Q&A today. But where this sermon ends is on what justice ultimately depends. We've outlined the contours of a new justice, but did you notice one commonality across those four questions that he answers? Did you see that there's one thing that has to shift in order not just to fulfill that ethic, but to arrive at the justice that he's reimagining for us? One thing has to shift in each of us: how we see ourselves and how we see one another, and especially those who are different from us. whether it's one who's out to harm us, one who's out to take what's ours, one whose demands we have a hard time respecting, or one who lays their disparity at our feet. Something has to change in us in order to change the way we see them and treat them. And what is that? Martin Luther, for all of his regrettable decisions and monstrous comments, still understands the conundrum that we're all facing. Because in his commentary on this passage, he says, quite candidly, the word is too high, it's too hard that anyone should fulfill it. This is proved not merely by our Lord's word, but by our own experience and feeling. Take any upright man or woman, he will get along very nicely with those who do not provoke him. But let someone proffer only the slightest irritation, and he will flare up. If not against his friends, then against enemies. Flesh and blood cannot rise above it. Brothers and sisters, that's true. Flesh and blood cannot rise above it. What will change this flesh and blood? What will change is when something happens to us that happened to Paul. The Apostle Paul, when he said, what's come over him is this. He regards no one any longer according to the flesh. And that means he does not look at who they are, what they look like, what they have as any determinant in how he will treat them. And for him to undergo that change, he had to undergo a second change, which he says in the follow-up to that line in 2 Corinthians 5, he says this, we no longer regard one another according to the flesh. Even though we once regarded Christ according to the flesh, we regard him thus no longer. Brothers and sisters, our only hope of not regarding one another in the flesh is that we see Christ as something more than just flesh, but as Lord. And the way we will do that is to look at him at his cross. Miroslav Volf, a Croatian man who has seen devastation, who has seen racial prejudice and racial violence in his Serbian and Croatian world in the former Yugoslavia, he says this, at the heart of the cross is Christ's stance of not letting the other remain an enemy and of creating space in himself for the offender to come in. Why would love for the cross of Jesus have that effect in us, an effect that would move in and through the church for the world to know and see? Because it's at the cross that we're reminded how deep is the darkness in each one of us. A darkness that required his death. A darkness that means that you and I have no place ever to think ourselves superior to someone else. Ever. The cross gives us that. And at the same time, it reminds us that we're dark. It also reminds us that we could not be more loved. So loved that we are made his own, not for anything in us, but entirely on the basis of his love apart from us. And what that means, especially in this day of lament with hope, is that whatever that you and I have to give up, whatever we might have to lose, even of our lives for the sake of following in his way, whatever we might be losing will never be a loss in light of what we've gained in him. And then the feud ends. And then justice rolls. When we see ourselves with a humility equal to the regard and love we have for another. No one like Jesus confirms to that truth to us, and there is no people like the church that have the resources to become a beacon of that justice. This city needs healing. This nation needs healing. I need healing. Our church needs healing. But the healing we need is never going to come through laws. It's never going to come through principles. It has to come from outside. We have to learn a new way. We have to learn a new song. And so after I pray here in just a moment, we're going to learn a new song. A song that is a cry to the Lord to heal us. Let's pray. Whatever we must do now, sir, we ask that you would help us to see and then the courage to act with love that is not of this world. In Jesus' name, amen.